Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of The Daily French Show. I am your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by the wise and venerable Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
I'm okay. I'm not sure I'm as wise and venerable as you sometimes assume, but other than that, I'm fine.
And joining us for the first time on the podcast today is Mr. Caden Lang. Now, before I go on with the asking how Caden is, I will have to warn our audience that he is out in the wilderness of South Africa and so does not have good internet. And for some reason, he can't always hear what I'm saying. Now, we can fix that behind the scenes. I can message him. But Caden, can you hear me loud and clear? And are you doing all right?
Yeah, how's it, Nick? Really happy to be here. Thank you. I'm a big fan of the show. So I finally cracked the nod. How's it, Terence? Yeah, I can hear you fine. It's a little bit broken up, but I can just, yeah, let's just carry on and see what happens.
We soldier forth, undaunted by the many trials and tribulations which challenge us. But anyway, there's a reason we have both Caden and Terence here, Caden's first appearance. And that is to talk about a case that has caused some controversy out in KZN, one of those wild west corners of South Africa, near the town of Dundee, although it's not quite in Dundee, as I'm sure Terence will explain. A story came out that a farmer had been charged with murder after shooting dead someone with a shotgun. And immediately, you know, as these things tend to do, there was a sort of spike in kind of racial tensions, and race baiters were, shall we say, crafting narratives about how this was a murder. And we sent Caden and Terence down to Dundee to kind of find out what was going on and what the real story here is. So, Terence, do you want to take us through what happened from the beginning, and then maybe we can just sort of go on from there?
Okay. Well, I suppose I should disclose up front that I am actually originally from Dundee, so you know, it's a part of the world I know well, and there's a certain emotional resonance with me. Glencoe is a smallish town. I believe it was really a sort of railroad terminus about 9 kilometers away. Now, what seems to be outside of any dispute is that there was an altercation over cattle, which had apparently been on the farm of Mr. Garth Simpson. His farm apparently adjoins sort of directly with the Sittambele Township, which is a part of Glencoe. Now, the control of livestock, I understand, has been a very, very big issue in Glencoe and in Dundee. In fact, it seems to be the object of some humor. There was while we were there, there was actually a photograph doing the rounds of a cow drinking out of a pothole, apparently taken just on the stretch of road that approaches Dundee. And I'm told that
rural South Africa in a nutshell.
Rural South Africa in a nutshell. And I'm told that on a sort of good day in Glencoe, you can literally drive around the suburban areas, if you like, very, very small place, and you can see cows wandering around. Now, this has been a source of friction between commercial farmers and, let's say, the sort of subsistence farming economy. Illegal grazing is no small thing. Grass is a very valuable resource. But more than that, there are issues with stock theft, which is a massive problem across the country for both established and emerging farmers, for commercial and subsistence farmers. And there are also issues with dangers in cows from different herds mingling together because of dangers of spreading disease. So this is something that to an outsider, you know, might seem like a non-issue, but to someone whose livelihood is invested in it, it is a particularly it is something of particular difficulty. Now, it seems that Mr. Simpson found some cattle on his property, which he impounded. It turns out then that well, at least the story that we've heard sort of from the Simpson camp, if you like, is that some of those cattle appear to be to have carried brands of another commercial farmer who had suffered some stock theft. A group of youths, including 17-year-old Khuliso Dlamini, apparently showed up on the property wanting to reclaim their cattle, and this is where the stories start to diverge. There are claims that Mr. Simpson demanded money for the release of the cattle. There are also allegations that one of the factors in the altercation may have been that some of the cattle that these youths wanted to take may have actually been stolen cattle, and therefore there was sort of legal implications to what would happen if the stock theft unit became involved. Be that as it may, a war of words ensued, and our understanding is that Mr. Simpson then went to fetch a shotgun, came back, and this is when the shooting happened. Now, a very interesting feature here is that Mr. Simpson's son actually filmed the whole thing on a cell phone, and the sequence of events seems to be that there is an exchange of words. One of the I believe a warning shot is fired. There is a further exchange of words, which seems to indicate that, you know, the next one might be more seriously directed. One of the youths then ducks through a gate in the barrier, seems to pick up a crop or a stick or something, and proceeds to attack Mr. Simpson. His companions seem to be shouting, "Don't do it," or "Don't hit him." The barrel of the firearm is seized, and then it's at this point that it appears the shot goes off. Now, this was certainly a fraught and intense situation, and Mr. Simpson's been charged with premeditated murder. On the evidence of the cell phone, this version has been described as untenable. It looks like it appears to be an accidental discharge, and from what we heard in the bail hearing, this appears to be the line that the defense is taking. Not only that, but that far from being the aggressor here, Mr. Simpson seems to be the one who's come under assault. The prosecution's view seems to be that the fact that he actually went and retrieved the firearm suggests that there was some sort of intent being formed, and a great deal was made about the distance, you know, whether it was 30 meters or 100 meters that he would need to go in order to fetch this. And on the morning of the bail hearing, the prosecution introduced a number of other charges: possession of unlicensed firearms and ammunition. Now, it turns out that the gun that was used, plus a number of other guns that were in Mr. Simpson's possession, were not, in fact, currently licensed. They had sort of been licensed previously, but licenses had all expired and hadn't been and hadn't been renewed. So it's a complicated situation. I suspect, and I'm simply saying this as an observer, and you know, we do hope to follow this case carefully, that the idea of premeditation, I think, will be hotly contested. But the question of possessing unlicensed firearms, I think that is going to be a more difficult one for the accused to walk away from. And I'm not sure how those two things come together when the weapon that led to the killing was itself not a licensed one, or not a currently licensed one. But for me, I think one of the most interesting things was listening to the prosecutor. One of the final questions he asked to the investigating officer was, if the Department of Land Affairs had taken these issues seriously, the grazing rights and the movement of cattle, and presumably providing grazing land to subsistence farmers, would we be in the situation? Now, I think that there's somewhat outside the expertise of the investigating officer. It was very interesting that he said no. So, you know, I think what we are dealing here with is make no mistake, it's a tragic situation, irrespective of whether there was a case of assault or whatever. A young person has lost his life. We shouldn't underestimate that or play it down. But this is happening in a context where the responsibilities of the state to its citizens has broken down, and many of these antecedent events could, you know, if they had been taken seriously, over the years before, we may well not find ourselves in this situation. Now, that does not speak directly to the criminal liability or otherwise of the accused, but I do think it speaks to the to the environment in the country. And I'd just like to close with one interesting observation. If you remember the case of Brendan Horner, another very tragic case, the anger and frustration of his supporters as they stood outside the court led them to try and force their way in to execute sort of instant justice. Now, that cannot be condoned under any circumstances. We saw almost the same thing happen at Garth Simpson's first appearance. And what this says to me is that this is a recurrent thing: a lack of trust in the authorities to actually see that justice is done, whether that is justifiable or not. But I think, you know, it speaks to a very dangerous set of circumstances that we as a country have arrived at.
I think that point is very well made, and we really are, to take the grand strategic view on this, we are facing the consequences of the deterioration of law and order, I think, in general in the rural areas. But Caden, let me come to you. I don't know if you're from KZN, but you currently are staying out there, out in the sticks, hence your dodgy internet connection. And I just wanted to ask, you went along on this trip with Terrence. What were your observations? What were your takeaways? What are your thoughts in general on this issue and the case before us?
Yeah, sure, Nick. I was born in KwaZulu-Natal. So we went up, and there are a number of interesting observations. I mean, I think first off, it was interesting for me because I'd never been in a courthouse and never kind of seen how this thing works. And I was actually quite impressed by everything the magistrates and and like the whole process around that. And but outside the courts, I actually expected a lot more trouble. Speaking to the farmers, I think that they expected large numbers of people because of what had happened the previous week. But I think there were about, I'd say 150 to 200 people outside the barricades, and everything seemed quite peaceful. And I mean, a lot of people are understandably very sad because, as Terence said, it's a very tragic set of circumstances, and they've lost a member of the community. But my first impressions were that the police were really, really organized around this whole thing. I mean, we were there at the courthouse very early, and the police were there in force. And what was quite interesting to note is that a lot of the policemen and policewomen were from out of town, so from as far away as Greytown. And so I think that they also expected a lot of trouble, but that just didn't really seem to materialize. I thought it quite interesting that there were quite a few political parties represented there, not just one or two. I mean, actually, in court, sitting just to my left, I found it fascinating that there were four people sitting there, one clearly an EFF supporter with the shirt, and then you had an IFP supporter, and then you had an ANC supporter with all of that regalia, and then sitting next to them was a young African lady proudly wearing a DA shirt. And so I just thought that was a nice thing to note there. But yeah, I mean, Terence covered it very well. It's a much bigger issue than just what happened on that fateful day. I think a lot of it is going to come down to the video in terms of the premeditated murder charge, different interpretations of the video. And just on that, I mean, I watched the video before we went up there, and like, of course, you kind of form an impression of what happened, but it was really interesting after listening to everything and then watching it again. You start to kind of pick up details that the rest of the public wouldn't after listening to everything. So I think just a note of caution to everybody watching the video and then kind of forming an opinion on the video. Just, yeah, I mean, it's just interesting to like see the whole thing contextualized in court and then watching it again, and you do kind of see it in a little bit of a different light. But yeah, I'm not sure. Do you want to hear a little bit more about the different arguments, or would you like to move on?
No, whatever you're keen on.
Look, I'd just like to interject something here. We spoke to a number of people outside the court, people who had come to show support or just interested, and it was, we didn't pick up a great deal of racialization of this. In fact, one member of his of the deceased family said just very clearly that this is, he doesn't view this as a racial issue. Unfortunately, I do think, and we've seen this again and again, that there is a certain predatory type of politician that sees something like this and sees an opportunity, not a tragedy. You know, I also spoke to Caden and I both to some members of the farming community, and you know, they talk about their frustrations with things like the vandalism offences and the indifference of the of law enforcement to this, that this is a sort of what the Americans would call a misdemeanor, you know, something a sort of petty a petty crime they shouldn't be wasting their time on, calls to open charges to open cases about this sort of thing are ignored. And I think that creates a very combustible environment. And when something like this does happen, there, as I say, there are no shortage of predatory politicians who will sweep in and apply the most incendiary interpretation to these events.
No, I think that's exactly right. And that is the real danger here. As IRR surveys have showed again and again, most South Africans are, you know, pretty on board with the project of rebuilding, reconciliation, working together, law and order, good economic policy, all that sort of stuff. But there are these figures, and they do hold an enormous amount of power in our media, in our academia, and within our politics, who are very desperate to manipulate emotions and drive racial tension, because there's no better way to mobilize voters, to mobilize patronage. And I'm both disturbed and heartened by some of the things you guys have just talked about. Interesting that there are many people who are not racializing this, and that's a pretty good thing, despite the efforts of, shall we say, some. But it's also good to hear that the cops were out there in force. They clearly don't want a sort of another breakdown of law and order like we had in some of these other cases, where we've come very close to having almost kind of mob justice, not just in the Brendan Horner case, but in other ones too, where, you know, there's all an incredible amount of tension around the trials themselves. So I'm glad to see that the cops were out in force. But still, not good that people did sort of cause some fuss outside the court.
Look, you know, we also had had members of the crowd sort of telling us that they wouldn't tolerate the granting of bail, and there would be, you know, blood on the streets and whatever. It's not a happy picture. And you know, I would just like to say to our listeners and to those who will read this as we cover it, that we will be following this case very carefully, and this is not the what we've given here is kind of an opening and an introduction. It's there is still much distance to go on this.
Yeah, definitely. And the reason we're covering
Nick, just before we kind of close the loop on that, would you mind if I just say one thing? The members of the farmers associations that we did speak to were very clear that they would like to call on members, well, traditional leaders, to all come together to try and resolve the issue, and that they really don't see it as a black and white thing. It's more a commercial farmer and like issues over land rights. And so they really are willing to meet with community leaders and traditional leaders to try and solve the issue so that the same thing doesn't keep recurring going forward.
Just sort of piggyback on that. Apparently, 80% of stock theft actually happens from emerging farmers, and questions over grazing rights and errant cattle ownership, major sources of tension within traditional communities as well. So this is a big issue, and you know what we are seeing is one sort of vector of it.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. And I just wanted to go into the reasons perhaps why we're covering this case, because you might be sort of listening to this and thinking, you know, murders happen in South Africa all the time, or killings or shootings or assaults or violence in general is such a common thing in South Africa. Why are we covering this? And it's because we wanted to make sure that this story didn't become another one of these distorted things which are used to play up race. We wanted to give a kind of version of events that might not be carried in the more general media, that just laid out the facts of what happened. And I think Terence and Caden have done a pretty good job of that. And obviously, like Terence said, we will keep following this case and making sure that we get all the details right in what happens going forward, so that this doesn't become a thing that hurts race relations.
Mr. Simpson is due back in court for the continuation of his bail hearing this Thursday. So we'll see what transpires then.
Definitely more to follow. All right. So we spend most of the show on that, but I think we have time for one more short little story. And this is a piece of news about the South African Department of Health, but it's also about migration, immigration into South Africa. So in a letter sent to prospective work seekers dated the 20th September, South Africa, the health department said that it was no longer going to be recruiting any healthcare applicants from Zimbabwe, because according to things that South Africa has signed up to, we're not really supposed to recruit any doctors from Zimbabwe because they apparently need them more. Terence, this is interesting. I don't entirely know kind of what to make of this. It's a strange thing about our migration policy. And it certainly doesn't seem like it's good for South Africa. And what do you make of it?
Yeah, look, you know, what they're saying is essentially that in order to work in South Africa, like a Zimbabwean doctor or nurse needs to get a letter of release from the Zimbabwean government, which I'm sure must be a torturous process in itself, which they then have to get certified by the embassy, I presume the Zimbabwe embassy in South Africa, in Tshwane, and then they can like apply for registration. There are concerns around the world, particularly among developing countries, that healthcare professionals are particularly mobile. I think there's certain other class of skills as well. So these people, you know, go and look for brighter futures. On the other hand, there's been a great deal of talk about regional integration being the solution to Southern Africa's economic future. You know, individually, our countries don't have large enough markets, so we need to bring them together. And part of that is naturally the flow of labor, not the flow of people, but the flow of skills and work seekers and whatever. And, you know, unfortunately, a country like Zimbabwe has been ruled by a decrepit, you know, quasi or perhaps not so quasi criminal, self-perpetuating gang for way too long. There's not much there, and or at least, you know, it isn't what it was in the 1990s, where, you know, people could still make a decent living. What I suspect will happen then is that, you know, many of these people, if they can, will find opportunities even further afield, you know, in Australia or in the UK or wherever. I understand that there are more Ethiopian doctors in Chicago than in Ethiopia, or someone has these things from time to time. More Malawian nurses in Manchester than in Malawi. So these skills are unlikely to stay in Zimbabwe just because South Africa refuses to take them. I think what this essentially does, given the strength of those push factors, is that it just pushes them out of Southern Africa. Meanwhile, you know, I know of people highly educated, highly qualified, definitely, you know, huge net pluses to South Africa, who have either been unable to secure a permanent residence here, or who have left because, you know, girlfriends or whatever weren't able to do so. And many, you know, many of these people have careers where they can not only find work abroad, but can take their South African work with them. You know, a friend of my late brother's did a lot of IT work. Said, you know, it's wonderful. You can sit anywhere in the world and work on a computer and work on a computer system in Joburg. And he left the country because his fiance was being endorsed out of South Africa. I think she was from the UK initially, and you know, they decided that she was just too much of an economic risk. You know, despite you know, having an income that just dwarfed anything the state was ever going to give her.
complete madness.
It's like trying to be half pregnant with globalization.
Very well put. All right, I'm afraid we don't have time to hear from Caden because we are out of time. But thank you very much for watching. I hope that
Caden will be back.
Yeah, he will be back. I'm sure he will, and hopefully with a better internet connection. And then we shall hear his pearls of wisdom flowing from him like a great bounteous river. I don't know where I was going with that. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed the show. Please like, comment, subscribe. Review us on iTunes, on Spotify, or whatever it is possible to do. So I don't actually know if it's possible to review on Spotify. But anyway, do share us. And yeah, we hope you enjoyed the show. And we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Have a good one, everyone. And keep the flag for liberty flying. Wait, that's a wrong podcast. But anyway, have a good one, everyone.